outlined in more.
Call the Senate Finance and Revenue meeting to order. Welcome, everyone. Well, we've been having hearings and having hearings and having hearings, and today we actually get to get some bills out of here. So to start off, Senate Bill 609 is not ready to go yet, so that will be put over until Tuesday. This is official notice that that will be taken up on Tuesday. Okay, so now I will find my agenda here first. And I will open a work session on Senate Bill 589. Dave?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, you will see Senate measure summary and a couple of amendments, and then revenue impact analysis and fiscal statement. And by the way, first, in terms of amendments, dash 2 contains everything in dash 1.
Oh.
And uses consistent language.
So we only need the dash 2.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
All right. So Senate Bill 589, as you recall from the public hearing, it repeals a five-year time limit for exemption from property taxation of Native American tribal land if acquisition of the land by the U.S. in trust status, so-called fee to trust conversion, has been requested or in process. It repeals a set of such exemption for property tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2012, and it applies to property tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2008. What the amendment does is it lists conditions under which property tax exemption for acquisition of the land in trust status ceases. A little bit of background information on revenue impact analysis. In your handout, there is revenue impact of proposed legislation to this Senate bill. If you come to impacting explanation in the second paragraph of it, the bill applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2008. This means that if this bill is enacted, the land currently in the fifth year of fee-to-trust conversion process will qualify for exemption, even if the process is not completed before July 1, 2009. So that additional element is captured in a revenue impact analysis. So you see some minor revenue impact there.
Okay, but we don't trigger any requirements on that. It's minimal, right?
It has some revenue impact for 09-11.
Okay.
And then in out years, the more this qualification is captured, and as a result, there will be a little bit more revenue impact.
Madam Chair,
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I would have is: these are dollars we're not currently receiving because they do have the exemption. So it's not like we're reducing dollars; it's just that we're deferring, or we're not going to get them. We're extending the time.
That is correct. Yes.
Correct. Okay. That's a good distinction to make. Okay, any questions before we get a motion from Senator Morse? Okay, Senator Morse, we have a dash 2 amendment here.
Madam Chair, I move dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 589.
Senator Morse has moved the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 589. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 589 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse has moved Senate Bill 589 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Telfer, would you like to carry this bill?
Be honored to. Thank you.
Senator Telfer is signed up. Okay. Now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 496. Chris going to do that or Paul's going to do that? Okay. Thank you, Dave. Okay, Paul, take it away.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 496, as you recall, this was a bill draft requested by the committee, and what the original bill did was suspend the 10% diversion of earnings that flow into the Education Stability Fund and into the sub-Oregon Growth Account sub-account. The original bill suspended that diversion for a two-year period and required a report on the performance of the Oregon Growth Account. The committee had testimony and worked with the treasurer, and the result is the dash one amendments to that original bill. And what that does is it, rather than suspend the 10% diversion, it reduces it to 5% instead of 10% for a four-year period. The original bill was a two-year suspension. This reduces the diversion from 10 to 5% from July 1 of 09 to July 1 of 2013. The bill also, in current statute, any earnings declared by the treasurer on investments in the Oregon Growth Account would flow into the commercialized research fund. What this bill does is corrects those earnings into the Education Stability Fund, the general account, rather than into the commercialized research fund sub-account. And that's the, it then comes back in 2013 and restores the 10% diversion, which you can see, that's why the language there goes back to 10% in section three, but restores it in 2013 back to the 10%, but it does the commercialized research fund declared earnings going into that fund, that is not restored. That's a permanent change in the dash one amendments. So there's a lot of fund shifting going on in the dash one amendments, and I have a revenue impact draft statement there for you. Trying to make this as trackable as possible. The top line is the Education Stability Fund itself has no net impact from this bill. It's still getting its 18%. If you hit the cap, then it drops to 15% of the earnings from the lottery. The Education Stability Fund general account, however, would gain revenue from this bill because, number one, the Commercialized Research Fund sub-account would be eliminated as a as the direction for earnings of the Oregon Growth Account. And so I plugged in $18 million there. This is based on a statement issued by the state treasurer to the Ways and Means co-chairs on March 4th and shared with the committee $18 million that he is waiting to declare as earnings from the account over the last few years. Instead of flowing into that sub-account, that would go into the general Education Stability Fund account. And the diversion, the reducing that diversion from 10 to 5%, and 09-11 would mean that $9.7 million would not flow into the Oregon Growth Account. Instead, it would flow into the General Education Stability Fund account. So the net of those two is $27.7 million in additional dollars in 09-11 that would be available in the General Education Stability Fund account. That estimate would be about $10 million, $9.8 million in 11-13. There's a couple of complicating things here. One is that if the if this bill becomes law before the end of the biennium and the treasurer declares earnings, it's possible that that $18 million could show up in the 07-09 rather than 09-11. I've just got it here for 09-11 for convenience purposes, but it could show up in this biennium if the bill goes through quick enough and the treasurer acts. The next thing is that the The overall stability fund numbers are slightly skewed, depending on your expectations of what's going to happen. The current forecast has the assumption that we hit the 5% cap on the Education Stability Fund in 09-11. So the actual dedicated revenue flowing into the overall Education Stability Fund would drop from 18 to 15%. And that's what these estimates are based on. If that's not the case, if you are to withdraw funds from the fund, Education Stability Fund, prior to that time, and it doesn't hit the cap, and you still have the current forecast, the amount that would be freed up for the general account of the Education Stability Fund would be about 10.2 million in 09-11 instead of 9.7, and about 11.2 million in 11-13. There's no estimated effect in 13-15 because there's just the four-year. It goes back to the 10% diversion on July 1, 2013.
Thank you for that explanation, Paul. Committee, you probably, this has been an issue for as long as the growth account has existed. Many people have questioned why the growth account would exist in the in what is basically a rainy day fund. It's a rainy day fund for education. As we learn more about this issue, we found that the account was put into the Education Stability Fund because that was the only constitutional way it could be allowed to own stock. And so that's why it exists there. And as we found out more about it, Senator Morris and I, in our meeting with the Treasurer, we found out that some of the investments of the Oregon Growth Account have indeed produced earnings, and we were very happy to agree to the Treasurer's suggestion that the earnings be declared back at this point to the Educational Stability Fund, and that this other fund, the Commercialized Research Fund subaccount, which has never actually been created, we'll just get rid of that. So basically, if the Oregon Growth Account is successful in stimulating new businesses in Oregon that actually create earnings, that's another source of revenue for the Education Stability Fund. So, and we were also very encouraged by the fact that the Treasurer in these very difficult times has agreed to actually declare the earnings, and he'll wait to allocate those until this goes through, and those can be in the Education Stability Fund, where we will certainly need them, if not in the short term, then definitely in the long term. So it was a very constructive process, I feel, and this is a good compromise. And the Treasurer also agreed to go down, to cut the allocation in half for 4 years instead of 2 years. Now, if the Oregon Growth Account starts taking off and a future legislature decides to end that sunset earlier, we certainly could do that. Senator Hess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that why we've not heard of the Oregon Commercialized Research Fund? Is because it hasn't been created?
That's correct.
Okay. I thought I was missing something.
Senator, there has not been any declared earnings from the Oregon Growth Account, so there's been nothing to be put into it.
Okay. What was the overall objective that distinguished from the growth account?
I don't know Senator, I don't know how well that was. How well I know what that objective was. I think it was a way to kind of reinvest earnings back into research efforts. But I don't think it was, at least not in statute, it's not really spelled out what that function would be.
And I want to especially commend Senator Morse for bringing this issue to us, because I think this is a very good thing for us to be doing in these very difficult budget times. Madam Chair. Senator Telford.
Thank you. Question. Aside from just moving monies between funds that don't exist or for whatever reason, this does have somewhat of an impact or not on the capital, the venture program, where new and entrepreneurial ventures have been funded. My concern is, has anybody done any study as to the amount of revenue that we're going to lose in the general fund because the payroll taxes are not being issued because these companies aren't being financially supported and partnered with the state as far as a venture capital approach?
Paul, I don't think we... Do we have any information on that?
Madam Chair, we don't have any specific estimates of the investments and how those dollars would be generated, but we do suspect, based on the performance of the fund and the information that Treasury has given us, that this diversion would impact on the economy would probably be a long way down the road. They have currently, in the Oregon Growth Account, they currently have commitments by the Oregon Growth Account, by the Oregon Growth Board, of $92 million. Mm-hmm. And of that $92 million, only $46.3 million has been called upon by the general partners. And recall the discussion we had. We had a number of them in to testify. So, in other words, there's $46.1 million now in the account remaining to be called, waiting for investment opportunities. So this would, all of these dollars will stay within the Oregon Growth Account. This bill doesn't change that. It just stops the flow into it for a four-year period. So it could potentially weigh down the road, but it would be after these $46 million have already been committed.
A follow-up?
Yeah, that's very helpful. So that even by taking out the $18 million, there's still $46.1 that's not even been requested yet. Or earmarked to be
allocated.
Used.
Yes, Senator, those dollars are committed by the Oregon Growth Board, and so they have made a commitment to the venture capital firms, and they know they've got that commitment as they look for investments. They have a commitment from the growth account to use those dollars. The $18 million is right now sitting in a money market account, essentially, and they're based on the previous investments, the other $46 million that's already been investment. That's the return on that. And so that $18 million won't affect the $92 million that's committed now.
Okay.
But if I may, Senator, of the monies that are committed but unexpended, it's still somewhat speculative. They're still in search of projects to invest in. So, you know, that money could sit there.
Mm-hmm.
And do nothing, or it could be put into play.
Okay.
Which is how we want it. I mean, we want them to be very careful about how they allocate this money. Okay, any other discussion? Senator Morris, we have a dash one amendment.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill or dash one amendments to Senate Bill 496.
Senator Morris moves a dash one amendment to Senate Bill 496. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 496 as amended to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 496 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I think I will carry this bill. Okay, now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 27. Paul.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 27 does not have an amendment. It is, again, a bill that originated from the committee. And what it does is it under current statute, any interest earnings that are not specifically directed to another fund account go to the general fund. So the general fund is the default for those interest earnings, and you've had some discussion actually from higher ed and others about wanting to retain some of those, but under current law, those flow back to the general fund. In 05-07, there was about $101 million of these interest earnings, but in 01-03, when the economy was, of course, in deep recession, it was 21.4. So you see this huge variation based on not only the economy, but how accurate our forecasts are. If our forecasts tend to be If we get more revenue than expected, like we did in 05, 07, we got these idle balances and generate more interest. If we're under forecast, like 0103, we don't have the idle balances and we get less interest earnings. So there's a real variation. If you look at the forecast for the next two biennia, it's $59 million in interest earnings. So what this bill would do is to, starting with the 11-13 biennium, has no effect on 09-11, starting with the 11-13 biennium, if that $59 million is the, turns out to be interest earnings, those dollars would flow into the rainy day fund. And again, I'm not quite sure why I get the bills that have a net zero effect, but they have all the fund shifts in them, but this is another one. And so, and again, trying to show that is that the general fund would actually lose $59 million because this bill becomes law that we pulled out of the close of session, pulled out of the state economist's general fund revenue forecast, and would flow into the interest, would flow into the rainy day fund. However, the bill also says at the end of the biennium, which would be the end of the 09-11 biennium in this case, because the transfer of the balances wouldn't occur until 11-13. Right now, under current law, up to 1% of the prior biennium appropriations go into the rainy day fund. What this bill would do is take that 1% and subtract the interest earnings that have gone in. So if it's, say, $150 million is the 1%, then you would subtract the 59 from that, and you'd deposit $91 million from the ending balance. So you would have, you wouldn't have a net effect on the rainy day fund from this, but you'd have the interest earnings flowing in to the fund. And again, the amount would vary, the ending balance contribution you would make, depending on largely on the accuracy of the forecast, whether we're above or below that. There's if you just look at kind of these trend baseline forecasts, again, it's moving dollars around. It does have some other effects, though. It does provide a source of revenue for the rainy day fund that we're almost certain will get some positive number in interest earnings. We're not always so certain we'll have a ending balance. My numbers here assume that we do get more than 1%. Therefore, we do have the $59 million offset from the ending balance contribution. So that's how it breaks even. But that wouldn't always be the case if we didn't hit the 1% on the ending fund balance. By the way, we have, historically, even going back to the mid-80s, we've always hit the 1%. Even in 0103, we hit the 1% because we tend to overshoot because we want to make sure we meet the constitutional requirements of a balanced budget. So that may even be the, even though times are, we have basically a $1 million projected ending balance now, we could well end up with an ending balance when all is said and done.
Okay.
The other thing I will add, Madam Chair, is that this does have a subsequent to the Ways and Means Committee.
Oh, okay. So the motion would be to send it to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Morris, do you have such a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 27 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 27 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Taylor.
Well, I didn't catch it before the motion, but the question is, another impact would be if we had excess. It would obviously reduce the kicker by $59 million in this scenario.
Senator Telfer, the impact on the kicker, again, would still depend on the forecast. Now, you'd have the interest earnings, the $59 million in this case, would not be in the baseline forecast. So if interest earnings turn out to be $59 million, it wouldn't have any effect on the kicker. But in most cases, it will in practicality, because when we tend to run over, that's when we have bigger interest earnings because we got more balances. So, for example, in 05-07, when we had the big kicker, if this was in effect, it would have reduced it,
right,
because we ran way over on interest earnings estimates too. So there would be that tendency, although it's not guaranteed.
But it probably wouldn't be enough to make the kicker kick or not.
There has never been a biennium where it actually triggered the kicker, no.
Okay. Any other questions, discussion? Okay. Any objection? Okay, so ordered. Off it goes to Ways and Means. Okay, now, last bill. Open a work session on Senate Bill 594. Senator House's favorite bill is about to be discussed. This is going to be carrying this. Thanks, Paul. Okay, Dave.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 594 permits property tax exemption claim for cemetery and crematory property, regardless of claimant's organizational structure or state of organization. By the way, the ORS Chapter 307-022 got passed in the 2005 legislature. Was interpreted by Clackamas County to assess property tax on a cemetery in the county. According to Cemetery Association of Oregon, there has been no other case of property taxation of qualified cemetery properties, regardless of organizational structures. The amount of property taxes at stake is a little over $18,000 in Clackamas County. So what this bill does is it sort of clarifies that statute should not be interpreted as the way Clackamas County interpreted. So it, regardless of claimant's organizational structure or state of organization, The property tax exemption claim for cemetery and crematory property will be permitted. That's what the bill does, and it permits claim for exemption for tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2008. And it also allows late filing for exemption claims and specifies late filing procedures, and it takes effect on the 91st day after adjournment sine die. And together with stat measure summary, you have revenue impact statement and fiscal impact statement.
Okay, and this would again only apply to the actual burial grounds and not to any buildings or improvements, that type of thing, right?
Yeah, that's actual burial grounds and then buildings on these properties are exempt from property taxes according to statute ORS Chapter 307-150. However, if you remember Chapter 307-022, it refers to I should remember, but it could be interpreted as that if the don't want to get into let me bring up the statute itself and I'm
okay. We'll stand at ease for a moment.
The ORS Chapter 307-022 is about status of limited liability companies owned by nonprofit corporations. In there, what it says is the entity qualifies for exemption or special assessment if and to the extent that all of the nonprofit corporations owners of limited liability company would qualify for the exemption or special assessment. So it indicates that to the extent that all of the corporation owner of the limited liability company would qualify for the exemption or special assessment. So the sanitary in question is paying for property taxes for a certain part, and then was exempt for the cemetery part. And it's been that way forever until 2005 statute.
Okay. Yeah, that was my question. I just wanted to go into detail because I want to make sure that Senator Hass doesn't mess this up on the floor. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do I read this correctly that a for-profit cemetery organization would receive a property tax exemption?
Senator Morris, Chair Burdick, according to Cemetery Association, it has the regardless of organizational structures, there has never been a case of cemetery being taxed for actual burial grounds.
I think the question was, would this give the exemption to for-profit? And the answer is yes, correct, for the burial grounds, for a for-profit cemetery, because that's what caused the issue to come up. Yes, the answer is yes.
Yeah, the answer is yes.
The
yes.
Chair rules, the answer is yes.
And Madam Chair, to follow up, was there compelling testimony that suggests that we exempt for-profits?
Well, as I recall the testimony, it was it's only the burial grounds themselves that are exempted, and that this had been practiced for years, that no, regardless of their structure, no cemetery had been taxed before, and then the assessor in, I believe it was Clackamas County, on this one particular cemetery started assessing the burial grounds. Is that correct?
Yes. This particular property has been exempt until this tax 2007 tax year. So it came as a total shock to the cemetery, and that's what triggers this Senate bill.
I guess maybe to reword my question, are there any cemeteries that now pay taxes that would not pay taxes that are owned by a for-profit organization?
That now pay taxes?
That now pay taxes.
Yeah, no. According to the Cemetery Association, no. The practice has been not to tax the actual burial grant.
So to persist, Madam Chair, if I may, we're not extending anything new. We're just clarifying an existing one-time problem.
Is that my understanding? Yes, that was my understanding as well. Do we have anybody here from the cemetery? Come on up and help us out here. We're just kind of muddling around. Yeah. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ty Cochran with the Cemetery Association of Oregon, and I can understand your confusion. If I can maybe start from the beginning, there's for-profit cemeteries and there's non-profit cemeteries. The for-profit cemeteries have buildings on them as a nonprofit would. If you're a for-profit, you pay taxes on those particular buildings, administration buildings, outbuildings, or whatever. The actual cemetery grounds, the actual place that someone would be interred in, has never been taxed for property tax ever in the state of Oregon or any other state. In the 2005 legislation, out of those 58 for-profit cemeteries, operating cemeteries in Oregon, 15 of them or so are owned by LLCs. And the 2005 bill that passed, the intent of that legislation had nothing to do with cemetery properties, of course. The owner of the cemetery in Clackamas County and the Clackamas County tax assessor got reading the statute of 05, and because prior to him owning it in the year 2007, it was always non-taxable. And because he was an LLC, the ownership status changed. And because he was an LLC, the 2005 bill, he fell into the category of being taxed on the actual burial ground. We, in turn, I should say the Clackamas County Tax Assessor went to the State Revenue Department, who in turn got some opinions from the Attorney General's office, and they in turn said that, yes, it's unfortunate, and it cannot be changed by administrative rules, so you have to change the statute. So the cemetery in Clackamas County, from the time of inception of the cemetery, has never been taxed, as any other cemetery. So it's kind of the unintended consequences of a 2005 bill that was something to do with the state bar sponsored it. The intentions was never to tax hallowed ground. And I guess some of the history behind it, if you got some time, is that, say I work at a cemetery here in Salem that's 55 acres and it has 40,000 graves in it. 30,000 of them are owned by individuals. Most of them are interred there, and there is no heirs. Well, who actually would have owned the property tax on that? For one thing, you never get it.
We could probably try.
Yeah, you could try. And I could supply you with the 30,000 names, but I think you'd waste a lot of postage
sending
out the tax
statements.
The only
thing we do in
this
committee is death and taxes.
Yeah, that's right. But, yeah, the cemeteries have never been taxed.
But that's just the burial ground.
Yeah,
it's not the building.
Absolutely. If you're a for-profit cemetery and you have administrative buildings on it, you pay property tax on that. Mm-hmm. Sunnyside Holding in Clackamas County, I saw their tax statement when I sent you the other day. I didn't send that, but they actually pay like $4,000 for the buildings up there.
Good. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much. That's very
thank you so
okay.
much. I'm glad you came today.
Thank you.
Senator Hass is also very grateful. Okay. Senator Morris, before we get ourselves into more trouble, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair.
There are no amendments to
it. I move Senate Bill 594 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 594 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Hass, would you like to carry this?
I am.
It's Senator Monroe's bill.
Yeah.
It is Senator Monroe's bill.
I'm going to have Senator Hass carry it anyway.
I'll avoid the temptation to make any puns and say I'd love to carry it.
Okay. All right. That completes our agenda. Thank you, committee. And I remind you, we do not meet on Monday, but we will meet on Tuesday. We are adjourned.